Ronald Purser is a professor of management at San Francisco State University. His essays and cultural criticism have appeared in the Huffington Post, Salon, Alternate, and Tricycle magazine. Beyond McMindfulness, which he co-authored with David Loy for the Huffington Post in 2013, led to his book McMindfulness, How Mindfulness Became the New Capitalist Spirituality, which we're going to talk about today. Dr. Purser began his Buddhist training in 1981 at the Tibetan Nyingma Institute in Berkeley, California, and is also an ordained Buddhist teacher in the Korean Zen Taigo Order. Thanks for coming on The Old Mole, Ron.
Thank you, Joe. Thanks for having me.
So your book, McMindfulness, is a fascinating interrogation of the development of mindfulness practice in the Western context. You wrote this essay about 6.5 years ago that was kind of what spearheaded this, and then over the next several years it developed into this book. What prompted you to write that essay, and what brought you to developing it into this book?
Yes, it was just about that time that corporate mindfulness programs were being offered in places like Google in Silicon Valley. I live in San Francisco, so I started taking notice of these. And I started to feel that there was some ethical issues in how these programs were being deployed as basically productivity enhancement techniques. I teamed up with David Loy, as you mentioned, who is a pioneer in what's called socially engaged Buddhism. And we wrote that article, and to our surprise, it went viral and caused quite a stir and a lot of debates in both the mindfulness and Buddhist communities. Over time, I kept tabs on how the so-called mindfulness movement made its way into other sectors, such as public schools, government, U.S. military. But I was somewhat ignorant of other critiques that had a lot of relevance to what was going on in the mindfulness movement. I had not read people like Henri Giraud, who is a critical educational theorist, Michel Foucault's work, and many others. I wasn't even familiar with how neoliberalism was a pervasive social philosophy that had impacts on our sense of identity. And so that sort of led me to put together this book as more of a comprehensive critique of mindfulness in the Western world.
And it also, from what I can tell, inspired you to start a blog of your own called The Mindful Cranks, where you've explored some of these issues in episode-by-episode depth. Could you tell us a bit about that and how it's been a part of this project?
Yeah, the podcast, it's called The Mindful Cranks. It's kind of a funny story because one of my detractors, someone who I've debated on Facebook, who is a proponent of secular mindfulness, called me a crank. So I appropriated that term and decided that to create a podcast to invite more scholars and teachers and practitioners that had more of a critical perspective on mindfulness, and that led to the podcast. So if you don't mind, I'd like to just give you an overview of what I mean by that. When I use the term mindfulness, there's several layers of what the critique is kind of encompassing. First is that if we look at secular forms of mindfulness, they've been decoupled from a moral and ethical context and commodified into a set of instrumental techniques, which then can be recontextualized or deployed for some very dubious applications and uses. Secondly, these practices, the way that they're being presented, can be used for more self-serving and ego-enhancing purposes. So these applications basically are presented as ways to reduce stress of the private individual. But by doing so, it's framed within a biological or biomedical paradigm. So these programs basically psychologize and medicalize stress and other social problems. They put a great deal of emphasis on self-regulation, personal control over emotions, but by placing the burden on individuals to accommodate and adapt to the status quo. So this kind of focus on self-regulation, it kind of induces a way of self-discipline. It's kind of a disciplinary form of power, where there's an obsessive self-monitoring of one's own inner states. And what it does is it kind of induces a social myopia, and it's displaced by a turning inward, like the inward turn. We're kind of provoked to endlessly work on ourselves, kind of endlessly work on self-improvement. And that creates a massive blind spot to the more political, economic, and cultural context that is, in many respects, causing the sort of distress due to systemic and structural issues. So this privatized view of stress, which McMindfulness sort of produces, it basically sends a message that our stress and anxiety is all inside our own heads. I find that very problematic, And if we take a step back, you know, mindfulness also signals that this is a huge capitalist industry. It's now valued at $1.5 billion. And basically, they're selling us back these individualistic, commodified cures to reduce the distress that we're feeling, which, again, the diagnosis is that we're suffering from a so-called thinking disease. Somehow, our stress is nothing but a problem of maladaptation to the environment. And so that's why I call it a capitalist spirituality, highly individualistic, accommodated to a predominant Western capitalist society. And that's how it's become easily co-opted. And it kind of suffers from this accommodationist orientation, which pacifies our feelings of anxiety at the individual level and then takes the ball off of the larger social and structural and political issues and inequalities that are at the root of a lot of social suffering and distress. So it promotes these salutary health benefits, but at the same time, it does so by becoming easily assimilated into existing systems. And it's presented as a salvific force that can then help us cope with noxious influences of capitalism. So mindfulness is all about how mindfulness has become subordinated to the economic realm and taken over by market forces. It appeals to consumer-based seeker of spirituality. It's like the Wild West out there now. We have spiritual, they're making all sorts of exaggerated claims. The genie's got out of the bottle, so to speak, and it's become like a panacea or cure-all. And that's kind of, I think, sums up, I think, the nature of mindfulness.
And so how is it different, or is it really that different from other sorts of ideological palliatives? There's positive psychology, even, you know, yoga has been kind of accused of being this colonized and appropriated kind of technology of spiritual and physical renewal that is just making it easier for us to adjust to a sick society.
Yeah, I think there's a family resemblance, and I think they're all under the same umbrella, so to speak. The happiness industry, as you mentioned, positive psychology, the focus on creating resilience in employees and individuals. Now there's a new one out there called grit. You just have to have the right amount of grit to be successful. They all sort of adhere to this bootstrapping notion that by turning inward, we can tap into our inner resources and pull ourselves up by our own bootstraps, no matter what our economic or social conditions are. And so, yeah, I think there's definitely a similarity of these wellness techniques.
Now, is the focus on individuality something that you think is very new, or is there a historical precedent for there being a tension between the individual and them doing what they can with that's within their control about their own suffering versus the wider world that actually constitutes each and every individual?
Individualism has been around for a long time in American society, kind of our national character and the wild, wild west, the rugged individual. But if we think of it more in terms of how neoliberalism, which is basically a complex cultural hegemony, basically an insidious worldview that we're individuals, as entrepreneurs, we're running our own enterprises, you know. So this ideology is that really we can pull ourselves up by our own bootstraps. We're basically economic actors in competition with others. And I think it's this really radical atomization, which has become exacerbated in many ways. And this is how I call it neoliberal mindfulness, because it plays on this rhetoric that happiness is just a skill. It's like going to the gym where you can work out. It's very individualistic. It's cut off from any sort of notion of community, the need for a safety net. Everything is sort of seen as the self-governance of free and autonomous individuals that need to self-regulate, to take responsibility for their own self-care. And in order to be employable, in order to thrive in a precarious economy. So it's this characterization of mindfulness as turning inward to private, interior, inner subjectivity, where we can have this kind of unfettered sense of agency, all can be carried out in isolation from the wider social, political, and economic structures. And this is what Michel Foucault called this the neoliberal turn. And he talked about a concept he called governmentality. And government is not just a political activity, but it's really how power relations function through our subjectivity. And so I'm drawing on his critique in a way, and trying to expose how institutions are shaping and regulating and informing behaviors and attitudes and our affective life. So this is a way of understanding how neoliberalism operates at these micro levels of power and kind of reformulates and reshapes what it means to be a person, our sense of self and identity. So, like you mentioned, the self-help movement, this whole self-help genre, which mindfulness is part of, it valorizes this idea of individual autonomy, freedom, choice, authenticity. These are all the things you hear in the rhetoric of the mindfulness movement. It's the ideology of autonomy, which penetrates deep into our psyche, but it kind of presents it as this is a expansion of our personal freedom. One of the key problems with this is that our personal troubles, our anxieties, our insecurities, our worries, are never connected. They're never attributed to political and socioeconomic conditions. They're always framed as psychological or individualized personal pathologies. And so we're led to believe that the way to reform society is through therapy or through these individualized interventions. And that's, I think, just part of the problem.
I guess what I'm trying to bring it back to is the Buddhist context, the original cultural context of mindfulness, and whether that has anything to offer in terms of showing how mindfulness could actually be connected to a transformation of society. Because on my research, the Buddhist tradition doesn't have a lot of things to say about the order of the world, that promulgating the Buddhist practice will transform individuals, and then individuals will be the ones who actually make the world better. And I'm wondering whether there is something within the Buddhist tradition that has to be confronted. I know in your book, you talk, and in some of your podcast interviews, you talk about how, you know, Buddhism and mindfulness isn't just about, you know, the present moment and this domination of our attention with the present moment, but that it actually involves a lot of thinking and a lot of risk-taking in terms of thinking things through. And I'm wondering whether there are things in the Buddhist tradition that the global situation today is calling on us to think through in terms of the causes and conditions of social and individual suffering, and how it's going to take social mass movements to actually end many types of suffering that the individual can't.
Yeah, that's a very good point. I've been thinking a lot about that. Well, first of all, when we say Buddhism, there is no one Buddhism. It isn't monolithic. So we have to be careful when we use the term Buddhism. But I think in general, you're absolutely right that if we try to look back to earlier traditional Buddhism, we're not going to get a lot of answers about social and political transformation. So traditional Buddhism, it does view the causes in the realm of suffering. They often refer to these as the three root poisons: greed, ill will, and delusion. Traditional Buddhism locates those poisons, the roots of suffering, within our own individual mind streams. But I think we need to understand the historical context better for these teachings, which go back over two millennia. Basically, these were monastics and renunciants who lived in very small communities. These monastics took voluntary vows of poverty, but they were taken care of. Clothing, shelter, they were taken care of either by lay devotees or by royal patronage. So they weren't starving, and in that respect, they could afford to be apolitical. And they relied, as I mentioned, on royal patronage. So in a way, the Buddha's early teachings were focused on the liberation of human consciousness. But on the other hand, the Buddhist teachings, his early teachings, were often directed to political rulers, and he offered many teachings to that effect. But you won't see any sort of systemic structural analysis of society or any attempt for social revolution in the Buddhist traditions. So I think we are now at a point where we're reinventing Buddhism as we go along, because we're translating. We're in the process of a cultural translation of Buddhism in the Western world, which has not been going on that long, maybe 100, 250 years. I think the problem is that it's landed in medicine, and it's landed in psychology, which have given Buddhism a tremendous sort of cultural legitimacy because it's appealed to this kind of Western rationalist scientific paradigm. The downside of that is that it's limited our understanding transformation, like the transformation of consciousness, for example, to focus on individual salvation. So both, I think, modern mindfulness and early Buddhism were limited in this respect to a focus on individual salvation, and they really didn't have the tools or the impetus to bring that into the social and public sphere. But that's not to say that we couldn't take some of the essential, you could say, radical processes of liberation and extend that into the more social and public sphere. So I think that it's interesting. The Dalai Lama, for example, announced, I think back 5 or 6 years ago, that he was a Marxist. In fact, he said he was half Marxist and half Buddhist. So I think there is compatibility of taking modern Buddhism and having a dialectical relationship with social and political thought that's just beginning to happen.
Do you think that the ethical moral foundation or framework for mindfulness practice that would be more liberatory could be found in modern movements for social justice, for reshaping the world in more democratic means through labor unions, through parties, through community assemblies? Could that become a framework, or is there something about the very specific way, the historical way that the teachings and the ethical priorities of traditional Buddhism are tied to what's liberating about mindfulness and other meditation?
That's a good question. As I mentioned in the book, in order to do that, to liberate mindfulness, so to speak, we have to really turn critique outwards. And what I mean by that is towards our social and political institutions, as well as the systems of power that are interlinked, that have exacerbated the suffering and collective stress. So in a way, we have to decolonize mindfulness and find ways to sever its ties to the marketplace if we're going to actually do that. And I think that requires a new praxis that facilitates critical reflection on the causes of our collective suffering, what David Loewy calls social dukkha. Dukkha is a term in the Buddhist tradition of suffering. So as he points out, these three mental poisons, which are usually seen as restricted and located within the individual, greed, ill will, and delusion, they're no longer limited to being seen as just interior afflictions. Rather, these mental poisons have become institutionalized and proliferated in our society, whether it's in the media, politics, economy. I think we need new theoretical resources and new explanatory narratives that can help expand beyond the boundaries of the biomedical paradigm, because that's where mindfulness has been situated. That has a very restrictive individual level focus. Also, suffering has been dehistoricized and privatized, and you know, this whole focus on blaming the victim, we have to kind of get away from that and see how our suffering is linked to social, economic, and political context, and help find ways through new practices that restore insight into seeing the linkages, the complex linkages of how power and privilege, for example, even among mindfulness teachers, has resulted in complicity and collusion with the status quo and with corporations, for example. So this is where we can draw inspiration from people like Henry Giroux, where we can have mindfulness programs that bring in critical pedagogies that reorient practices towards examining the conditions of social suffering, oppression, collective experiences of trauma, systemic racism, other forms of marginalization. And it cannot all be reduced to the psychological and to the individual. So I think it's important that the Buddhist view actually rejects the individual as the primary unitary reality. This is some of the radical teachings, for example, is that the teachings on no self or anatta, that the individual is really a process that is inseparable from other processes. So that means the whole ideology underpinning the contemporary neoliberal conception of the human, it needs to be displaced in some ways by this wider vision of how our suffering is interdependent. There has to be much more emphasis on interdependence. If you think of the term compassion, which is often used quite a bit in Buddhist circles, it really means suffering with others, or co-suffering, you could say. So this is kind of the movement towards a more socially engaged mindfulness, or a more socially engaged Buddhism, where we can come up with new practices that confront and really call into question these oppressive social institutions that are often the cause of suffering. And so I think that's the direction I'd like to see, how we can kind of take back this movement away from its capitalist stranglehold.
Thank you, Ronald Purser, for coming on The Old Mole today to talk about McMindfulness, how mindfulness became the new capitalist spirituality.
Thank you, Joe. Thanks for having me.
Bhagavate Vaisajya Guru Vaidurya Prabharajaya Tathagataya Arhatte Samyak Sambuddhaya Tanyata Samungatisva.